righty. Let's take a look at the book of Habakkuk. We're on page 203 in your exegetical outline notes. It should say outline the book of Habakkuk at the top of the page there. This is an overview of the book. It starts out with an introduction, and then there are just two major sections. Major section number one is the burden of Habakkuk. That's what we'll get through this evening, chapter 1 and chapter 2. And then if you'll turn the page, on page 204, you'll see the second major division is the prayer of Habakkuk. And that is a great section of Scripture, one short 19-verse chapter packed with all kinds of neat stuff about the second coming. So it may take 2 hours to go through that chapter alone and finish up the book. But that's a great chapter I want you to anticipate. It's really encouraging, got some really neat stuff in it. So that's the basic outline of Habakkuk. Now turn over to page 205 in your notes, and you see at the top of the page, exegetical notes, the book of Habakkuk. We'll start in verse 1. Verse 1 is our introductory verse, and we, of course, use that as an excuse to give you some of the background information before we get into the text itself. So, chapter 1, verse 1. The oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. Now, you see his name there, Habakkuk, in Hebrew. Point 1, it's from the word chavak. The Hebrew word chavak, point A there, means to embrace. And it's emphasized, the embrace is emphasized with the last consonant being doubled. So the name that Habakkuk has could very well be translated full embrace. Big hug. Bear hug, maybe. You want to put it in English, huh? Bear hug or full embrace. And this will become very, very applicable at the very end of the book. We'll see what or who Habakkuk fully embraces. Point B is family. We know nothing about his family. There is a Jewish tradition about who he was. You see point A there. The rabbis, some of the rabbis feel that he was the son of the Shunammite woman. Shunam, the woman from Shunam. Okay? Okay? Now this is pure tradition. There's no evidence to substantiate this tradition at all. Now, the event with the woman from Shunem deals with Elijah. Elijah was a prophet, and she was a very apparently well-off woman. Her husband had a good farm or something going, and he would come by, and so she said, let's build a prophet's chamber for this prophet. Okay, remember, so they built a little extra room on the top of their house for Elisha and Gehazi, his helper. And she was rewarded with a miraculous birth. She wasn't, apparently she was barren. And so she had this little boy. And then a few years later, when he's old enough to go out into the fields, we don't know exactly how old he is, he goes out into the field with dad and he says, my head, and he collapses and they bring him in and he dies in his mother's arms. And so the Shunammite woman sends for Elisha, he comes and the boy is resurrected. That's the event that takes place in 2 Kings. And in 2 Kings, you see point B there, 2 Kings 4:16, when Elisha is predicting the birth of this child, this miraculous child, he says to her, thou shalt embrace, you shall chavak, you shall embrace a son. And so there, because Habakkuk's name comes out of that root, bingo, he's the son of the Shunammite woman. So it's a little bit stretched, isn't it? But that's the rabbinic tradition. That's the rabbinic tradition. Okay, the date. There is no date given. We can only look to internal clues to give us an idea of when this occurred, when the book was written, what events it talks about. The first three are on the bottom of the page. Habakkuk is told that Babylon will rise to power, and that will be a marvel, will cause Israel to wonder with a great wonder in verse 5. The second clue we get is that it must come before the fall of Nineveh in 612, because Babylon rose to empire status and then defeated Nineveh, Assyria. So after the defeat of Assyria, it wouldn't be a surprise that Babylon was a major power. So the book must come before the fall of Nineveh in 612. But it must come after 640 because in verse 5, God is going to tell Habakkuk, I'm going to do something that will be done in your days, in your lifetime. And so this has to happen between that outer range, 612 to 640. On page 206, we get a fourth clue, the superscription, the last verse, I think it is, of verse of chapter 3, verse 19. There's a superscription there in verse 19. Yeah, it's the last verse. And this superscripture indicates that the Levitical priesthood was operating or in session when this was written. And if that is true, if that clue is correctly understood, then that would be during Josiah's time, good King Josiah's time. Now, because of that superscription, some scholars think that Habakkuk was a Levite and a member of the temple choir. Now, he didn't have to be, but because he wrote the psalm at the very end of the book, they think maybe he was a Levite. Who knows? Question.
What's
the superscription? In the psalms, you usually get a little introductory statement before the psalms that say, Psalm of David on something like that. Well, that happens at the end of Habakkuk's psalm. Chapter 3 starts the prayer of Habakkuk, which is in poetry form. And then at the very end, in verse 19, you see, for the choir director on my stringed instruments. It falls at the end. He just reverses it in his psalm. It's often called a superscription because it precedes the psalm, but here probably would be better to call it a postscript, something like that. Okay, so what is our conclusion regarding when this book was written? And I'll pass out this chart to you in just a minute. Probably between 640 and 622, as it says there, more likely during the reign of Josiah, 626 to 622. So Habakkuk falls right in this time period here with Nahum and Zephaniah and Jeremiah, after the destruction of the northern kingdom by Assyria, but before the exile to Babylon of Judah in 586. So right about in here, the late 600s. So let me pass out this chart to you so you can add it to your notebook and you can position Habakkuk in his historical framework here. I think you can see from this chart that there were very definite times when the prophets were prominent. They didn't just happen throughout the history of Israel. Here we have a section here. We've already looked at Obadiah, Joel, Hosea, Amos, and Jonah. They all happened about the same time. Isaiah and Micah were together. Now this group of prophets down here before the exile. And when we get into the remainder of the minor prophets, we have Haggai and Zechariah right after the return, and then Malachi in about 445, right about there. So there were very specific times in which the prophets were active. Okay, how's that chart going? Everybody have one? Anyone need one? Okay, these are the extras, maps and chart. Okay, thank you. By the way, those of you that are new, in case you didn't know, the back lessons are up here, all the handouts. That if you've missed a handout, it's right here. I'll be throwing out the old handouts from November, so if you want any, feel free to pick them up. And then we have tapes, student loaner copies of the tapes we make, in case you miss a class and want to get caught up on it. Also over there, you would check them out for a week. Okay. All righty. That's approximate time period of Habakkuk. Now the locale, point D there on page 206, is Judah, probably Jerusalem, again due to that superscription or postscript, whatever you want to call it, at the end of his psalm. It's for the choir director, for the Levitical choir, so they have to be in some proximity to Habakkuk to get hold of this. Okay, point E, the historical setting. Point one there, it's a time of outward prosperity for Judah. But you see point two there? It's a time of inward corruption, outer prosperity, because Assyria, point three, is no longer the military political threat that it once was. Still a strong power, but not as dominant as it once was. And so Judah is prospering outwardly, commercially. But inwardly, the people are not following the Lord. Point four, good King Josiah made some reforms in the religious life of the country, but they turned out to be superficial. They didn't really get down to the heart of the people. They were external changes, not internal heart changes. And so Judah, we'll see, is continuing to sin, continuing to offend the Lord, continuing to break the Mosaic covenant. Point F, Dr. Fruchtenbaum has put down four major points. One is the fact of divine discipline. God will discipline his people, then and now. If you are trusting in the Lord and you're not walking with him, you can expect discipline. And of course, the Jewish people are covenant people. We're in covenant relationship with the Lord under the Mosaic covenant. And so the Mosaic covenant included curses for disobedience, discipline for disobedience. The second major point we will look at is the fact that sin is self-destructive. If a country or an individual gets into sin, it's going to lead to, in the final end, to their death, you know. But sin is self-destructive in little ways, and if you continue sinning, in big ways. Point three is really the theme of the book, the just shall live by faith. And we'll take a look at that. And finally, point four, a point that's very meaningful to me, and I hope it's meaningful to you, is that all this junk we have to put up with now, all the injustices that we see around us, all the evil that people seem to get away with, will be rectified at the second coming. We have to keep our eyes on the kingdom and on the second coming, and not get burdened down by all the stuff that comes our way, both personally, through the news media and all that. All injustices will be rectified at the second coming. As far as the New Testament goes, Habakkuk is quoted four times, and you see that there, once in Acts, once in Romans, once in Galatians, and once in the book of Hebrews. So the book is referred to on a number of times in the New Covenant. Page 207. At the top is the theme of the book. I already gave that away. The just shall live by faith. If we're walking with God and we are just in his sight and righteous in his sight, we aren't going to see all the details. We aren't going to get all the answers. We're going to have to trust. We're going to have to trust. Walk by faith. Okay. The phrase in verse 1 is the burden or the oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. Point 1 there is the Hebrew. The Hebrew word there is masa, not maga. That's a typographical error. So if you want to correct that, it's M-A-S-A. And for those of you that know Hebrew, the dot over the sheen is in the wrong place. There's two typographical errors. The dot over the sheen is incorrect. It should be to the left side. It's a seen, and then the G should be an S. It's masa. And the word masa means an oracle or a heavy message. We use the same terminology today, don't we? Ooh, dude, that's heavy. Okay? We use the same kind of terminology. But he's, Habakkuk, sees a heavy message regarding his nation. He has a burden. This message weighs him down. So that's why it's called a masa, heavy message. Point two, he's entitled Hanavi, the prophet, which shows he was recognized as a prophet. We'll see what established him as a prophet when we get to verse 5 in chapter 1. So he is recognized as a prophet. He didn't just come out of the sky. And finally, point three is the word chazah in the Hebrew there, which means a vision. So he saw the key prophecy. He didn't hear it as much as he saw it. There are words here. There is a discussion between him and God, a brief exchange. But the bulk of what he reports to us, he saw. So he was a seer. Did you see that term in Scripture, S-E-E-R? It means someone who saw. So he saw a prophetic vision, a seer. We'll get to that vision next week. And point four deals with the unique nature of Habakkuk. Point A, he doesn't particularly prophesy to the nation, but he has a dialogue with God. He isn't saying to the nation, "Thus saith the Lord," but he's talking with God over a problem with a one-to-one dialogue, short little conversations. Point B, he's not so much concerned with delivering a message. Others will deliver the message. You'll see that. Others will deliver the message. He's interested in solving a problem, and this problem has bugged us all. Every single one of you has asked the question that Habakkuk asked, and you will get your answer tonight. I've asked this question. It's bugged me. It's burdened me down. It's an old, age-old question, but the question will be answered. The problem will be solved in just a few minutes. So he imparts God's message as it came in dialogue and not through straight discourse, as it says there. Okay, that's our introductory material. Let's move now to page 208. And while you're turning to 208, we'll hand out the chart of the time frames of Habakkuk. I try to get, for you folks that are new, a time frame chart that gives you an idea of how the prophet is bouncing along the timeline. He doesn't stay in his presence. He bounces back and forth, and this is the advantage of being a prophet and receiving revelation from God. God is not limited by time, and so when he reveals information to his prophet sees information in the present, sees it in the future. He can go back and forth between the present and the future. Something that drives us nuts, makes it hard to interpret the books, but it's something we have to deal with. Okay, everybody have their time frames chart. Thank you. Okay. All right, let's take a quick look at this. Habakkuk is going to spend the vast majority of his time in his present, 626 to 622 BC. He's going to spend most of the time there, but he's going to take us on a couple of excursions into the future. He's going to pop into the Messianic kingdom in verse 14. We'll get to that tonight, back to his present time. And then next week, when we jump into chapter 3, you're going to see that the vast majority of chapter 3 is spent in the tribulation period and dealing with Yeshua's second coming. There's a lot of great stuff there about the second coming. So it's going to be a great chapter. And then he'll finish up in his own present time. So there is the majority of the book, right in his own present time, with a couple of quick jumps into the future. Okay, so let's begin with the first dialogue. We're on page 208, point A. Habakkuk's going to complain to the Lord. Two complaints. So we start with his first complaint, point A there. The first complaint in verse 2. Let's take a look at verse 2. How long, O Lord? How long, O Lord, will I cry for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you, violence! Yet you do not save. You ever felt that way? Lord, when is this rotten world going to be over with? You know? How come that these wars can go on? How come terrorists can strike? How come down the block my friend gets shot down in a drive-by gang shooting? You know, Josh's best friend just lost his brother to a drive-by gang shooting. His brother's got involved in drugs and all that stuff. How long is this going to go on? You know? Boy, I identify with this. So point one there, we see that he has cried out to the Lord. He has prayed many times to the Lord regarding this issue of sin and violence. But what's happened? A big arrow in the sky? A neon light, a neon word in the sky? Nothing has happened. Point two, God doesn't seem to answer. The skies are like brass. You know, when will God ever act to make things right? Point three there, you notice, his key issue is violence. He mentions it six times there. How long must violence reign? I've asked that question many times. I hope you have as well. I hope you felt the burden that Habakkuk feels. He feels it terribly. Second complaint, verse 3. Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Why don't you ever change things, God? Have you ever felt that way? Ever asked that question? When and why? Now, I think one application we can get out of this is the fact that God can handle our concerns, okay? Here Habakkuk is complaining to the Lord in, I think, very strong terms. But you know, God can handle it. We'll see that in verse 5. We'll see that. So if you felt this way, you know, take it up to the Lord. Don't hold it in or think it's somehow unrighteous or unspiritual to let him know how you feel. He already knows. He already knows how you feel. Psalm 139. Read that psalm over and personalize it. He already knows what's going on in your heart. The frustration and all that. The burden you feel. So tell him about it. You know, build your relationship with him. You know, let him know. Nothing wrong with that. Do what Habakkuk did. David did the same thing. It says in the Psalms that David screamed out to the Lord on occasion. He can handle it. Don't worry. He's not going to zap you with a lightning bolt. He can handle it. He loves you. He knows what you're going through, and he wants you to relate to him in the middle of it. Okay? All righty. Why don't you change things? So point one there, not only does God not seem to be doing anything about violence, but point one, to make things worse, here's God's prophet, and whenever God leads him, he sees it get worse and worse. And there's a logical progression here. The first thing he talks about is iniquity. Point A, iniquity, the word there means moral evil that has a tragic result. Sin is destructive, self-destructive. The second word, perverseness, in the Hebrew, speaks of trouble and misery and pain and grief. It's a word that has a broad range of meaning, but it speaks of trouble and misery and pain and grief. So iniquity, moral evil, brings the tragic result of pain and grief. And this iniquity also brings the pain and grief of destruction. And the word in the Hebrew there means greedy and cruel plundering. And this would be by wicked people who are focused on personal gain at the expense of others. So we have iniquity, moral evil, bringing pain and grief and misery and trouble and destruction. What happens when people are out trying to take advantage of others and plunder them? Strife, point D, and the Hebrew word there basically means lawsuits. Lawsuits! When somebody's going after you, you want to protect yourself, don't you? Lawsuits. And the result of lawsuits is contentions and quarrels as you go at each other in the courts. Does this sound like 21st century America?
No.
You're right, Bonnie. Bonnie's back. I can always count on a good response. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Sounds familiar. We are now a lawsuit happy litigious society, whatever that word is. We have lawsuits right and left. Why? Well, it's the same progression that happened in Habakkuk's day. Moral evil brings on trouble. It encourages people to plunder others, and people fight back. You know, they try to protect themselves with lawsuits, and then you have these quarrels. It can be between neighbors. You know, it can be between companies. It can be between countries. So point two here. This shows the prophet's sensitivity to this sin. This is a heavy burden. It shouldn't be this way in Israel. We're supposed to be living under the Mosaic law. We're supposed to be a righteous people. Shouldn't be happening in Israel. Shouldn't be happening in any country, but if the country is not focused on the Lord's way of doing things, it's going to. So that's why it's a burden. Point four, or I should say verse four. Therefore, the verse starts out, therefore the law is ignored and justice is never upheld, for the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, justice comes out perverted. You know, and he's still complaining at God. God, because of verse 1 and 2, because you don't seem to care, because you don't seem to act, all this happens. And what happens? Number one, lawlessness. The law of Moses is not kept. See, the law of Moses was added. We got the law of Moses in Galatians 3:9, I believe, says the law of Moses was added. Why was this added? It was added to Israel at Mount Sinai. Why? To provide boundaries to deal with behavior, to let people know what sin is and how to live properly, how the covenant people were supposed to live. Here's your way of life. Here's the boundaries you're supposed to live within. But instead of being a lawful nation, the law of Moses is being broken. And the result is injustice. Justice is perverted, and the wicked always seem to get the upper hand. Again, is it any different for us today? I hope we all feel the same burden. All right, let's move over to page 209. God's going to respond. Is he going to blast Habakkuk? How dare you talk to me? You ungodly man? No, he's not going to do that. He's going to respond to his servant. And he's going to give him an answer to this. And this is an answer we need to pay attention to. If we've asked these questions, here's God's answer to us. Verse 5. Look among the nations. Observe. Be astonished. Wonder. Because I am doing something in your days. You would not believe it if you were told. Basically, what God is going to do here, we'll see in verse 6, is to bring the nation of Babylon, the Chaldeans, to empire status and use them to discipline Judah. Okay, now, who are the Babylonians? Here's a quick map of the Babylonian Empire. Here's Jerusalem, where Habakkuk is. We're very familiar with this area of the world now, right? Here is Babylon, the capital of the Chaldean Empire, the Babylonian Empire. And they swept up the Fertile Crescent, taking out Assyria. There's Nineveh, the capital of Assyria, taking out Assyria and coming down the western side of the Fertile Crescent and taking over Israel as well. That was the Babylonian Empire. Now, they were quite an amazing bunch of people, quite a sophisticated civilization. Here is a map of ancient Babylon. Here's the modern Euphrates River riverbed that we see when we see those aerial or satellite pictures of Babylon, anything like that. There's the ancient Euphrates riverbed, but here's the ancient bed here running right through the city of Babylon, right there. And you can see there's a number of temples there. Temple of the New Year's Feast, A, that would be that one. Temple of Nimach is a B. There's another temple in that location. Archaeologists have uncovered a number of temples. So it was quite a sophisticated city. The Nebuchadnezzar built his hanging gardens there. Here's an artist's rendition of what archaeologists think Babylon may have looked like. Here's the Euphrates with a river going across it. There's one of the temples. So what temple is that? I think that's probably Ishtar, Temple of Ishtar, Marduk. I don't know. All kinds of temples there. What does the map say? Maybe I can figure it out. Anyway, nah, I won't take the time. There's a temple, a ziggurat there. So it must have been quite an imposing and impressive place. Now, the archaeologists have uncovered the Ishtar Gate, and it has been reconstructed. This isn't on the grounds of Babylon, but this is the way the Ishtar Gate probably looked. This is a full-size reproduction of the thing. I forget where this is located, but really quite a beautiful piece of work. And here's another artist's rendering of the Ishtar Gate, and looking out across the city at some of the temples. Here's the Hanging Gardens. This artist has included the Hanging Gardens. Sorry it's so crude. I got it out of my CD World Book Encyclopedia. When I blow it up, it gets kind of crude, doesn't it? So that is the city of Babylon, capital of the Babylonian Empire. Very sophisticated and powerful people. Okay, they rise out of obscurity in verse 5. If you'll turn to your notes, point A, God tells Habakkuk to look among the nations. You know, what do you see out there? Well, he didn't see the Babylonians at this time. They had not risen to empire status. They were a conquered nation. You see, they were powerful, and then Assyria destroyed them, and they stayed in a conquered, subjugated condition for a number of years, and then they rose a second time to empire status and took vengeance on the Assyrians. And so when Habakkuk looks out among the nations of the world and he sees them rise to empire status, he's going to wonder a great wonder. And the Hebrew is repeated there. And point C, here's a critical comment. It's going to happen in your day. This is the phrase that authenticated Habakkuk as a prophet. See, this is a short-term prophecy that Habakkuk is sharing with us. The unexpected is going to happen during his lifetime. It's going to be verifiable, and it's going to be, in this sense, miraculous. Remember, the test of a prophet that we looked at earlier consisted of two things, two parts. One, the prophet had to show supernatural knowledge of the near future and some kind of a testable prophecy. And then secondly, and most importantly, his doctrine had to conform to all that Scripture taught. So this is that evidence that he is dealing with God. God is revealing material through him. This is supernatural evidence of the future. It's going to happen short term, so it can be verified. This is why he's called Hanavi. And of course, you've seen, I think, with all our prophets, every single one of them is verified this way. They didn't just pop out of the air. Point D, basically, if someone had told you that this was going to happen, you would never have believed it. And someone in the morning class said, we know that Babylon is going to be the capital of the planet during the tribulation. We'll see that as we continue on through the minor prophets. The city of Babylon will become the Antichrist headquarters and capital of the planet during the tribulation period. And if I told that to somebody who doesn't believe the Bible, they wouldn't believe me, would you? You know, if you were told that, it would never happen. But it's going to happen. And this is the same situation that Habakkuk was under. If anyone said Babylon is going to rise to empire status, they would have said, no way. But it's going to happen. Okay, the rise to power is brought out in verse 6. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people, who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places that are not theirs. So the Chaldeans are described as bitter. And remember, this is their second rise to power after being defeated by Assyria. This is their second rise to power. The NASB translates the Hebrew word there, fierce. I read fierce to you. The Old American Standard translates it bitter. The word speaks of their cruelty to the subjugated nations, the people they conquered. Point B there, they're described as a hasty people. Now, the NASB translated that Hebrew word as impetuous. I read impetuous, but hasty is probably a better translation. It speaks of their speed of conquest. So they're going to be cruel. They're going to come quite speedily. And then point C should say breadth of the earth. Does that say that in all your stuff? Breadth of the earth. Mine is different. I discovered that today. And this reference to describing them as coming across the breadth of the earth describes their rise to empire status. They will not just be a mighty localized empire. They will come across Assyria, across the whole Fertile Crescent there. And then they will possess dwellings not their own. Again, a reference to their conquest. Reference to their conquest. Now, just for your study, I've got an article on Babylonia here to pass out to you. Here's a quick little article that you can read tonight. I'll expect a five-page paper next week. So here's an article on the Babylonian Empire. I've covered it very briefly. You can see there's more to cover, but this is, again, a brief article just for your knowledge there. You have a picture of that artist's rendering of how Babylon looked, and then on the back side, there's a photograph of some of the ruins of Babylon. By the way, did you all know that Saddam Hussein started to rebuild Babylon? Because he figured he was the next Nebuchadnezzar, so he started to rebuild Babylon. So the rebuilding of Babylon is underway. That rebuilding will culminate in the tribulation when Babylon becomes the capital city of the planet. Tell that to your friends, they're going to say, no way. History is going to repeat itself in more enlarged terms. Okay. The description, verse 7, of their conquest here. Verse 7. They are dreaded and feared. Their justice and authority originate with themselves. So verse 7 emphasizes their independence. They set the rules. They recognize no one but themselves. We set the rules. We are the boss. So they suffered from extreme pride and arrogance. We set the standard for the world. Their speed of conquest in verse 8, their horses are swifter than leopards and keener than wolves in the evening. Their horsemen come galloping. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swooping down to devour. Very vivid imagery there, isn't it? But they their conquest comes quite quickly. And by the way, this swooping down like an eagle is not the U.S. Air Force or anybody else's Air Force, as some people have interpreted the term eagle. So remember, the picture of an eagle is swiftness. That's the idea there. We came out of Egypt on eagle's wings, God says of the Jewish people. The U.S. Air Force didn't take us out of Egypt away from Pharaoh, but we had a swift departure, etc. So that's a consistent symbol in Scripture. Their invincibility in verse 9. All of them come for violence. Their horde of faces moves forward. They collect captives like sand. Now, you just saw that, or just heard that I read the NASB, and they translated a kind of a difficult phrase, their horde of faces moves forward. I really think other translations have done a better job. For example, the NIV and the New Living Translation, amazingly enough, have translated this a little differently, and I think they're more accurate. They all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. And the New Living Translation does the same thing. On they come, all of them bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a wind from the desert. That probably is a little bit better than their horde of faces. We'll see this this metaphor of the wind in the next verse as well. But I think he's Habakkuk. God is comparing them to this hot, unstoppable, violent Khamsin that comes out of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, sweeps everything before it. You know, our troops, when we invaded Iraq, had to put up with that kind of sandstorm. It covered their teeth. It got into everything, swept along before them. And that's how he's describing the Babylonians. They're going to come across the Fertile Crescent like a sandstorm. And like a sandstorm, easily conquers everything. Verse 10 and 11 describes them in the same terms. Verse 10, they mock at kings and rulers, and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Then they will sweep through like a wind and pass on. And so there's that same imagery. That's why I think it's a better translation of that phrase, this desert wind metaphor again, blowing across the desert, sweeping the sand before it. And the sand, in that metaphor, are the nations that the Babylonians are conquering. Last part of verse 11, and then we'll take a break. But they will be held guilty, they whose strength is their God. We learn in verse 11 here that the ultimate object of worship for the Babylonians was their power and might. They had plenty of temples, as we've seen in the map. They had plenty of idols that they worshipped. But their ultimate object of worship was their military strength, their power. And this sin is going to lead to their downfall later on, and which brings out our theme there, that sin is self-destructive. And so our first dialogue is over. Habakkuk has said to God, God, Judah is sinful and violent. Why don't you do something? God says, I will. I'm going to bring Babylon in to discipline my people. How will Habakkuk respond to that bit of news? We'll look at that in 15 minutes. Listen for the shofar, and we'll come back for chapter 2. Gather ourselves together here and take a look at the second dialogue on page 210 of the book of Habakkuk. All right, we start out in verses 12 through chapter 2, verse 1, with Habakkuk's complaint. He starts out with a note of assurance. He's just been told that Babylon is going to come in and judge Judah. But he's confident that that judgment is for the purpose of discipline, not to destroy the nation. So he starts out with a note of assurance. Verse 12, chapter 1, verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We will not die. You, O Lord, have appointed them to judge. And you, O rock, have established them to correct. So why is he confident that Israel is not going to be wiped out? Because the Lord has always been Israel's God, point A, and because of God's holiness, what he's done, covenant relationship with Israel, who he is, holy. He doesn't break his promises. So those are two reasons why Israel will not be destroyed, because of what God has done, and because of who he is. He's reliable. And you notice the personal nature of Habakkuk's comment, O Lord my God, my Holy One. He has a close personal relationship with God, identifies very closely with him. So he knows who God is and his relationship with Israel, and then he recognizes the place of Babylon in God's plan for judgment, for punishment, for correction, not destruction. just to judge the nation. And so again, the idea comes out that God will correct his people, both then and now. And this whole idea transfers over into the New Testament too. We will be disciplined by the Lord if we turn our back on him. And that's exactly what's happening to the nation of Israel in verse 12. But even though Habakkuk has a correct understanding of God's response to him, I'm going to bring Babylon upon Judah, he has a problem in verses 13 through 17. The problem comes out in verse 13. Your eyes are too pure to approve evil, and you cannot look on wickedness with favor. Why do you look with favor on those who deal treacherously? Why are you silent when the wicked swallow up those more righteous than they? And we can summarize that comment. How can a holy God use the Chaldeans of all people to punish Israel? Point A, it's true that Judah is wicked. I've just admitted that. But the Chaldeans are even worse. They're even worse, God. And you know, the same principle holds true today, that God can very well use a people or a person or a nation that's even worse to punish us. You know, when I think of Israel today, you know, we're not living for God. 90% of the Israelis are atheist or agnostic. We're not experiencing the blessings of the covenant. We're experiencing the curses of the covenant. Can God be using as perverted a person as a Muslim, fundamentalist, terrorist, suicide bomber to be disciplining us today? Can he be using someone as perverted as a Muslim fundamentalist suicide bomber to punish the U.S., to discipline us today? You know, those guys that ran their planes into the World Trade Center, they're pure evil. Hard to think of somebody worse than us, but they are. And how about some young man who goes in and tries to blow up kids on a school bus? Pure evil. Why is God allowing that? Same principle could be holding true today. I think it is. And when we see what's going on in Israel today with the suicide bombers, we ought to feel burdened just the way Habakkuk was. How can you use them, Lord, to do that to us? And that's the same question we need to ask ourselves today. The Israelis may not be good, but the Islamic fundamentalists are even worse. And the sinfulness of the Chaldeans is now brought out in verses 14 through 16. Here's the evidence that they're worse than Israel. Verses 14 and 15. Why have you made men like the fish of the sea, like creeping things without a ruler over them? The Chaldeans bring all of them up with a hook, drag them away with their net, and gather them together in their fishing net. Therefore, they rejoice and are glad. He uses quite a metaphor here. The nations that the Babylonians are going to capture are pictured as the fish caught in the Babylonian net. And so the nations are going to become like a fish easily captured by the Babylonians, and the Babylonians are going to revel in it. They're going to love it. Hey, this is cool. They're going to like it. Worse yet, verse 16. Therefore, they offer a sacrifice to their net, and they burn incense to their fishing net. Because through these things their catch is large and their food is plentiful. The point of verse 16, point B there, is they don't even glorify God who's using them to do this. They are giving their glory to their military power, their net. They're not even aware of God's overriding power. So the glory is not given to God, but to their military power. They're glorifying themselves. We did it. We did it. And so the question comes in verse 17. Will they therefore empty their net and continually slay nations without sparing? Is this going to go on forever, Lord? How far are you going to use them? How long is this going to be allowed to continue? Can you feel the burden on Habakkuk? Can you feel how he's pressed down? You know, this is the way I feel when I think of Israel today. I think of my people. Every time a suicide bomb goes off, I think, how long is this going to go on? You cry out to God, and it never stops. It doesn't stop. The Al-Aqsa Intifada has been going on about 3 years now. When is this going to stop? Well, the prophet felt that way too. His reaction comes out in verse 1 on page 211. Chapter 2, verse 1, page 211 at the top. How does Habakkuk respond? Verse 1. I will stand on my guard post and station myself on the rampart, and I will keep watch to see what he will speak to me and how I may reply when I am reproved. He hasn't gotten an answer to his prayer, has he? We saw in chapter 1 that he's prayed many times over this burden. Hasn't gotten an answer. Now he gets one he doesn't like. Does he turn his back on God? He's upset. He's mad. He's frustrated. He's angry. He's burdened down. But does he turn his back on God? No, he gets alone with God and trusts him. This is his faith. Okay, I'm going to wait. I'm going to wait till I get my answer. So he hangs in there with the Lord, doesn't he? And sometimes that's what we got to do too, don't we? And God responds to his prophet. We don't know how long Habakkuk waited. I have a feeling it wasn't too long. But God responds in verses 2 through 20. He talks about a vision that Habakkuk is going to see. Verse 2. Then the Lord answered me and said, record the vision and inscribe it on tablets that the one who reads it may run. Okay, he's going to see a vision, and he's going to write down what he sees. And the amazing part about this little statement to me is that we're going to be reading what Habakkuk wrote down some 2,500 years ago. He was written down for us to read, for his people to read in his time, for us to read in our time. You know, this is very similar to what the instruction Isaiah was given as well. Isaiah chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, he's told to do a similar thing. Then the Lord said to me, take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters, swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. I've got a message. I want you to write it out. Isaiah's message is quite short. Habakkuk's is a little longer. Same idea there. Okay, now he's going to write it down. Why? So everyone can read it. He's not going to proclaim it to the nation. He's not going to stand up in the street corner and say, thus saith the Lord. He's going to write it down and people are going to read it. But there's a reason why they're going to read it. Point B. So they can then tell the message to others. He may run who reads it. After they read it, they're to go out and tell that message to others. So, you know, Habakkuk is not going to be preaching to the nation. Others are. Those that read this message are going to be preaching to the nation. Getting it out. So, here's evangelism. You know, we're told to do the same thing, aren't we? We read the Bible, we're to get it out. We're to get it out to the world. You know, in the Jewish community, the rabbis very proudly say today, we don't proselytize, you know, kind of the superior attitude. But it's right there in Scripture. That's what Habakkuk's to do. He's to get people getting the message out, get the warning out to Israel. Okay, the timing of this message that he is going to write down, he's going to see this vision, he's going to write it down. The timing, verse 3. For the vision is yet for the appointed time. It hastens toward the goal. It will not fail. Though it tarries, wait for it, for it certainly will come. It will not delay. So the timing we see there is for an appointed time. The word, the Hebrew word used is moed, a fixed time of fulfillment. It's the same word used for the festivals of Israel in Hebrew. The festivals of Israel fall at a fixed particular time during the year. And this vision will have its fulfillment at a very particular fixed time. And it's going to be fulfilled. It will come. It's not going to come right away. You're going to have to wait for it regardless of how long it takes. This is very different than the book of Amos. Remember, Amos saw two visions when we went through his book. Those visions were not fixed in time. And Amos prayed, oh, please don't bring that stuff upon Israel. And God said, okay, it will not come to pass. There was an option there. But this, there's no option in this. This is going to come to pass at a certain time. And the timing, we'll see in a little bit. Now, the rabbis assign this verse and this timing to the Messianic times. As far as the rabbis are concerned, in Sanhedrin 97b, in the Talmud there, Sanhedrin 97b, and in the rabbinic commentary Yalkut, Y-A-L-K-U-T, they say that this is referring to Messianic times. And they're right. They're right. This vision will be fulfilled in Messianic times. And so we're still waiting for it. And we should take the, we should heed the words here to Habakkuk. It's going to happen. Wait. Wait for its fulfillment. I have a certain time. Okay, so there's the vision. He's to write it down. We're to wait for its fulfillment. And then we come to a very important message in verses 4 and 5. Verse 4. Behold, as for the proud one, his soul is not right within him, but the righteous will live by his faith. Point A there, you see that to disbelieve God shows pride. You know, the one who doesn't have the right soul toward God is the proud one. The one who says, I know better. The one trusting in self. And what's the result of that? The result of that is death. You know, the Proverbs 14:12 says, there's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. There's a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is the ways of death. Proverbs 14:12. But to believe God, point B there, is to show faith and to show humility. God knows better, not me. God knows when this vision will be fulfilled. He knows the proper time. God knows the proper discipline to bring upon my people. And to trust in God has the result of life. As the result of life. And you know, the rabbis saw this as a very, very important important verse. They felt it summed up all that God was requiring of us. Here's Makot 23b in the Talmud. Rabbi Simlai, here's what he said. Moshe gave Israel 613 commandments. That's the Mosaic Law. David reduced them to 10. Isaiah to 2. But Habakkuk to 1. The righteous shall live by his faith. So the rabbis see this as a summary of all that God has for us. And they're really right there. They really have picked it up correctly there. Okay. So God is saying to Habakkuk, I'm going to take care of this moral problem. That's my business. You leave it to me how to handle it. As for you, you trust in me. You trust in me, Habakkuk, and let me take care of it. Message for us as well. Okay, verse 5 is on page 212 of your notes. And in verse 5, point 2 at the top, we see that the sin of the Chaldeans will carry the seed of their destruction. A number of their sins are brought out here. The first one is their drunkenness. They were characterized by drunkenness, chapter 2, verse 5. Furthermore, wine betrays the haughty man so that he does not stay at home. You see point one and two there. Xenophon and Herodotus are two Greek historians, and their writings affirm the Babylonians' drunkenness. We go to point three there in Daniel 5. We have another example of that. The Babylonians were drunk when Babylon fell to the Medo-Persians. Had they not been drunk, partying, they would have defeated the Medo-Persians. They're also characterized by a hunger for power, the second part of verse 5. He enlarges his appetite like Sheol, and he is like death, never satisfied. He also gathers to himself all nations and collects to himself all peoples. So the Babylonians are like Sheol. Sheol is the place of the dead. All the dead go there, but Sheol is never satisfied. Always wants some more, some more. And that's brought out in Proverbs 30, verses 15 and 16 as well, this whole thought. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. There are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. And the first one he names is what? Sheol, death. Sheol's got to be defeated and conquered. It's never going to be satisfied, folks. There's never going to come to a point in time where Sheol says, enough, you guys can live for now. Our enemy, death, has to be defeated. Then he adds the barren womb. And I guess you ladies know how tough it is to be barren. When women want a child, it's a big burden. Earth that is never satisfied with water. The earth can suck up the water no matter how much you pour on it. And fire. And fire. We saw that with our fires this year, didn't we? You know? Fire will burn up anything you stick in it. Any house, any building, anything. But anyway, the point here is Sheol. Sheol is never satisfied. Point two there refers to the Babylonians. No matter how many nations are conquered, they always want to conquer one more. You know, when John Rockefeller was asked how much money it would take to make him happy, you know what he said? $1 more. Just one more. Never satisfied. So we should add him to the list there, huh? Sheol, the barren womb, the earth, fire, and John Rockefeller. And the Chaldeans. Do you identify with this? There's lots of people like this in the world. There's lots of people, lots of nations like this. Saddam Hussein was this way. He just wanted one country more, you know? Hitler was like this. He just wanted one country more. Okay. In verses 6 through 20, point C, the nations that were conquered by the Chaldeans are going to judge them, and they will take up a taunt song against the Chaldeans, and the elements of the song are brought out. First of all, verse 6. Will not all these take up a taunt song against him, even mockery and insinuations against him, and say, woe to him that increases what is not his? For how long? And makes himself rich with loans. Now the Chaldeans were well known for demanding tribute from their conquered nations. The NASB translates that loans. I think a better translation would be heavy debts. If you have an NASB, you read loans there. I think a better rendering would be heavy debts, something like that. So these nations were conquered and put under tremendous economic burden. And those are the ones that are going to taunt Babylon. In verse 7, will not your creditors rise up suddenly, and those who collect from you awaken? Indeed, you will become plunder for them. They're going to be attacked by surprise. And this will happen when the Medo-Persian Empire will arise and defeat them. And then these conquered nations will plunder the Chaldeans. They'll get what they dished out. They'll reap what they sow. Verse 8. Why else is this going to happen? Because you've looted many nations, all the remainder of the peoples will loot you because of human bloodshed and violence done to the land, to the town and all its inhabitants. And so the Chaldeans will reap what they sow. And so the first part of this taunt song is that the Chaldean, the plundering Chaldeans will be plundered. The second woe is that their dynastic building will collapse. You see, the Babylonian kings are pictured here as a building. They wanted their descendants to sit on the throne of their empire forever. So it's pictured like a building, something that lasts for a while. Verse 9 here. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to put his nest on high, to be delivered from the hand of calamity. So they tried in verse 9 to set up a long-lasting dynasty. Here it's the picture of an edifice that lasts for many, many, many lifetimes, like the pyramids, something like that. But they did this through wholesale slaughter in verse 10. You have devised a shameful thing for your house by cutting off many peoples, and so you are sinning against yourself. So sin is self-destructive. They built their monument on the blood of others, and it will destroy them. And their sin is so obvious that even their building is going to witness against them. Verse 11. Surely the stone will cry out from the wall, and the rafter will answer from the framework. They're not going to get away with it. Even their very own building will witness against them regarding their sin. Going on to page 213. A third woe is brought against the Chaldeans. The first one, they will be plundered. The second one, their dynastic building will collapse. The third one, they will experience violence because of the violence they dealt out. Verse 12. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed and founds a town with violence. So they built their cities with the blood of slaves. They built their empire on the backs of those they conquered. Verse 13. Is it not indeed from the Lord of hosts that peoples toil for fire and nations grow weary for nothing? And the point of verse 13 is that all this labor, all this effort that the Chaldeans have put out is destined for destruction. It's going to go down. It's going to burn. And the reason that Habakkuk, or that God gives to prove that this is all going to go down, is in verse 14. Here's how I know it's all going to go for naught. Verse 14. Why? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And in this verse, Habakkuk takes that quick jump into the Messianic kingdom. Boom. One verse, and then back to his own time. The reason why all that the Chaldeans strive for, all that any man strives for, using blood and violence and perverseness as his tools, is destined for destruction, because someday God is going to rule over this planet. Someday God is going to rule during the Messianic kingdom. And when he rules, all this garbage is going to be laid waste. And you know what will literally happen to Babylon? Because like I said, Babylon is going to be rebuilt for the tribulation period. And then in the kingdom, we learn from the various sections of Scripture, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Revelation, that there'll be two places in the kingdom that will be a burning wasteland. One will be Edom. We've looked at that already. But the other place will be Babylon. Babylon will be the second place of a burning waste during the kingdom. Two places. And this is found in Revelation 18. Revelation 18. Isaiah 13 and 14, Isaiah 13 and 14, Jeremiah 50 and 51. Revelation 18, Isaiah 13 and 14, Jeremiah 50 and 51. When God rules the kingdom, Babylon will literally be a burning wasteland. All this will be gone. Then, in verse 15, he pops right back to his present time again. He just gives us a little glimpse at the future at this point. Now, back to the present day and the fourth woe against the Babylonians. Their debauchery will work against them. Verse 15. Woe to you who make your neighbors drink, who mix in your venom even to make them drunk, so as to look on their nakedness. Seemed to be a great sport that the Chaldeans had to get their neighbors drunk so that they would get them so out of their mind that they would take off their clothes and be degraded and humiliated by their nakedness. So they're encouraging a behavior that is immoral, that degrades their neighbor and humiliates their neighbor. Dehumanizing joke here. A dehumanizing practice. So what does God say about that, the little fun little party game they had there? Verse 16. You will be filled with disgrace rather than honor. And now you yourself drink and expose your own nakedness. The cup of the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter disgrace will come upon your glory.